The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
The only real way to reform the civil service system is to reform the political system. And no government's going to reform the system that put it into power.
Well, the thing is to get the Prime Minister to see the danger.
That's your job.
Welcome, everyone. It is Thursday, May 11th, 2023. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing. It's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Trying to reform any part of government at a time when it's next to impossible to have our elected MPs and MPPs even listen to we the people is a monumental task. Fortunately, there are those who are up to doing exactly that.
Our guest today is Bruce Pardee, member of the Ontario Bar, professor of law at Queen's University, and executive director of Rights Probe, a division of the Energy Probe Research Foundation, and their website is rightsprobe.org. I encourage people to go there to have a look at Bruce's work. Bruce presented at the National Citizens Inquiry, which is currently touring Canada, trying to get the opinions of people affected by the actions of our governments, both provincial, municipal, and federal, of course, surrounding the COVID pandemic. And some of the testimony has been horrific to listen to say the least, really heart-wrenching. Now, Bruce presented asking the question, why did the legal system fail to protect our civil liberties during COVID?
And that's the very question that will be addressed today, and the answer contains a myriad of legal, political, historical, moral, and cultural dimensions. And we have reached the point where a solution for the people appears to be one that can only be created by the people. Our broadcast today focuses on the highlights and essentials of the full conversation with Bruce that was originally posted to Just Right's video channels during the past week, and which are available on Rumble, Odyssey, YouTube, and BitChute. What you'll be hearing today adds yet another dimension to that discussion, which begins right after this reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
Hi, Bruce. Hello again.
Hello, Robert. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. So, Bruce, before we begin our discussion, give us, please, a synopsis of your presentation that you give at the National Citizens Inquiry, and then we can get into the nitty-gritty.
Thanks, Robert. I will try my best to be succinct. This question that I tried to address during COVID, why did the legal system fail to protect civil liberties? And there may be many ways to answer that question, but I focused on two. The first one is that the whole COVID debacle is a symptom of the triumph of the administrative state. And then second, why didn't the charter step in and fix it all? Well, because the charter, the way it has been drafted and then the way it has been interpreted and applied by courts, does not now oppose the premise of the administrative state. I'll address the administrative state first. So we have a basic idea in our system of governance, the idea of a separation of powers between the three branches of the state. And the three branches are the legislature, which legislates, of course, the courts, which adjudicate, of course, and then the third branch, which is the administration or the executive branch of government. And one of the reasons for having a separation of powers is to protect us all from a concentration of power. the separation of powers means that the legislature is not supposed to be dealing with particular cases. So, you know, if the government doesn't like you, it's not going to be able to legislate a specific law just for you. It legislates general rules. And then courts don't have carte blanche to do whatever they want. They have to take the rules created by the legislature and apply them to particular cases. And then the third branch, the administration, the basic rule about their powers is that they have no power. No power except the authority given to them by the legislature in a statute. So that's all fine and good, except that what has happened more in modern times, and it's not just modern times, it's not just COVID, this has been in development for a long, long time. But what has happened is that the separation of powers between these three branches is starting to dissolve. Legislatures, instead of passing rules and statutes, often now delegate their rulemaking authority to the administration. Courts, instead of watching over what the administration does and making sure they have a mandate to do what they do, the courts now, and not across the board and not absolutely, but courts are inclined now to defer to the authority of the bureaucrats and officials and experts inside the administrative branch of government. So you have delegation from the legislative branch, you have deference from the judicial branch, and as a result, what you get in the administrative branch is the discretion to decide what the public interest is. And that is what I call the holy trinity of the administrative state: delegation, deference, and discretion. And that means that when we have spent our time during COVID discussing things like whether or not lockdowns are effective, or whether or not the vaccines have been tested properly, or whether or not masks work, we are really questioning whether or not the policies adopted by the administrative branch of government are in the public interest. And that's a fair question. It's legitimate. We want to know the answer to these questions, of course. But we're sort of missing the point, because the premise of the administrative state is that officials have the discretion to decide the public interest. So the fact that we might disagree is really not that important. They have the discretion to decide that. And until you challenge that premise, I think most other things in governance terms are just arguing in the margins and not getting at the central reason why we got into the debacle that we did. So that's the short version of the administrative state problem. The short version of the charter problem is this. The charter appears to be a roster of individual rights and freedoms. It's certainly drafted that way. It looks to be solid. These rights and freedoms are stated in black and white. It's a constitutional document. People think that it's there to protect them, and it will protect them, and it hasn't. And why is that? It's partly because of the way the text is worded. It's partly because of the way courts have interpreted those words over time. It is a myth. I'll start with this. It's a myth that our legal system starts with the charter. The charter is not the foundation of our system of government or our system of law. One of the foundations is this idea that I mentioned, the separation of powers. But even that is starting to dissolve. And in its place is this holy trinity of the administrative state: delegation, deference, and discretion. But what happened with respect to charter rights during COVID, I like to put it this way. Governments and agencies and public health officials went around the back door. They went through the gaps. They did indirectly what the charter might not have allowed them to do directly. So here's an example. If the public health officials or the government or the ministry or whoever had decided to impose a literal vaccine mandate, as in, you will be vaccinated, or we will fine you or throw you in prison. Okay. Now that's, in legal terms, that's an actual coercive mandate. And we have Section 7 of the Charter, which guarantees life, liberty, and security of the person. And it is likely, I would like to think, that that kind of actually compulsory vaccine mandate would breach Section 7 of the Charter. And then we go to Section 1. Section 1 is the reasonable limits. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen in that stage of the analysis in a courtroom. But nevertheless, you'd start with the proposition that that kind of literal vaccine mandate would violate Section 7 of the Charter. But that's not what we had. What we had was policies that looked coercive, but were actually voluntary. You needed a vaccine passport to go to a restaurant. You might have needed a shot to keep your job and the like. Vaccine mandates to go here and there to travel on a plane or a train. And the version of this that you heard from governments was, well, you don't have to. It is still your choice. But choices have consequences. And if you choose not to get a vaccine, well, then maybe you can't fly in a plane. Maybe you can't keep your job. Maybe you can't go to a restaurant. But it's your choice. And therefore, it's not compulsory in the legal sense. And therefore, it's not a violation of the Charter. And legally, that's not a bad argument. The comparison that I like to use is with the no shirt, no shoes, no service rule. So let's say government creates a rule that applies to retail establishments that says you can't go into a store or a restaurant without a shirt and shoes. And let's say there's somebody who doesn't want to wear a shirt and shoes, and they say, well, I have the right to bodily autonomy. You can't make me put stuff on my body. And that's true. But the response is, but you don't have to do it. You don't have to go into the store. You don't have to go into the restaurant. You don't have the right to demand to behave as you wish anywhere you are. The rest of society agrees, or essentially agrees, that we don't want people bare-chested in a restaurant or a variety store. So it might be a violation of a type, but it's not a charter violation. You have the right to decide not to do it. And this is the same argument being made with respect to the vaccines. You saw this echoed in Justin Trudeau's comments most recently about how he didn't actually require anybody to take a vaccine. That's echoing this argument. Yes, we had policies to encourage people to take a vaccine, to enable them to do things, but we didn't actually require it. And the experience in the courts over COVID, with respect to challenges about all kinds of things, including vaccines, were largely unsuccessful for these kinds of reasons. Not exclusively. There are all kinds of variations, of course, in the nature of the cases and the reasons that the courts gave. But the resort to the charter was largely unsuccessful because the policies fit in the gaps. They did indirectly what maybe could not have been done directly. Or in other situations, the court found that although the particular policy did violate a charter right, like the prohibiting of gathering in churches and so on, they did violate the freedom of association, maybe the freedom of religion. Nevertheless, they were justified under Section 1. So there's a whole host of variations, but the bottom line is that the charter has not responded, and it has not responded to these violations of civil liberties for understandable reasons, even if we don't like them.
Misinformation and disinformation is carrying people to believe things that are untrue. And vaccinations is a perfect example of it. Like any modern bit of medical advancements, there are potential side effects in vaccinations. And there, you know, are people who've probably gotten very sick from vaccinations. On the billions of people who've been vaccinated against COVID over the past few years. But there are far more people who obviously have died due to COVID, died from not getting vaccinated. And the idea that people can fly in the face of science, well, individuals are allowed to make their own choices. There may be all sorts of different reasons why someone is hesitant to get vaccinated. But I make a distinction, and I have always have, between someone choosing for personal reasons to choose not to get vaccinated and someone deliberately using misinformation to mislead and scare other people with so-called facts that aren't facts at all, that lead them to make a choice that endangers their lives and the lives of other citizens. So as Prime Minister, through the greatest public health crisis that we've faced in 100 years in this country, since the Spanish flu, my responsibility was to keep as many Canadians alive as possible. And all of the scientists and the medical experts and the researchers, not just in Canada, but around the world, understood that vaccination was going to be the way through this. And therefore, while not forcing anyone to get vaccinated, I chose to make sure that all the incentives and all the protections were there to encourage Canadians to get vaccinated. And that's exactly what they did. We got vaccinated to a higher level than just about any other of our peer countries. And that's why we had a less deadly pandemic than most other countries.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Freedom Feature. I'm your host, Barry Bussey. With me today, I have Charles Fichtner, who is a retired public servant, but still very much interested in public affairs. And in particular, he's enjoying his observations. We're enjoying his observations with respect to federal, provincial, and municipal politics. Charles, it's great to have you here with us tonight.
Very pleased to be with you.
Awesome. Charles, we've been talking about you and I, and that this is one of the things that we have been really concerned about in recent times, and that is the level of public confidence in our public institutions. And you and I have been chatting about this, and I wonder if you could just share some of those thoughts.
There's a recent Angus Reid poll, and in it, they looked at a number of public institutions to see what the public confidence had been. And they compared numbers from 2021 and today. So we're looking at just a 2-year period. And public confidence in the House of Commons has apparently dropped from 52%, an appallingly low number to start with, to 38% in the last 2 years. And confidence in the Supreme Court has dropped from 69% to 54% in those same 2 years. So that raises very interesting questions about what people expect of the House of Commons, what they expect of the Supreme Court. And if our confidence levels have dropped down to the levels of roughly 40% or less, that raises serious concerns about the nature of those institutions, about how they're performing and how that performance compares to what people would expect. I started to work and I developed a draft of a book, which I think I mentioned to you, called Lost Principles of Our Civil Heritage. And what that book did is it looked back historically, as far back as we have records in the heritage of the West, going back to ancient Egypt, ancient Sumer, ancient Babylon, and on, and try to see what was articulated as the principles that allow us to live together well as human beings. And what's the role of government in keeping those principles applied? And so what I was trying to find out is not what was what the disagreements were between one philosopher and another, one politician and another. I was trying to find out what was the common ground. What did we keep trying to strive to achieve to allow people to live together comfortably and well in a civil and civilized way? What becomes clear is, when you look historically, is that there were principles that were articulated over and over and over again.
There was the three, the Holy Trinity, we're saying discretion, delegation, deference, but there was another point that you brought up during your testimony to the National Citizen Inquiry, and that was mootness.
Right.
Could you explain?
Yes. So the job of courts is to resolve actual cases. If you went to a court and said, you know, I have a question. I have this scenario in my head. I don't know what would happen. Will you please resolve it for me? They would tell you to go away because it's not a real case. It's hypothetical. They don't do hypothetical cases. Mootness is a situation where an actual case, a real case between real parties with a real problem, becomes a theoretical case because something changes. Let's say there's a challenge to a rule. And the person challenging the rule, you know, complains about the rule because it's causing this kind of a problem for them. And then the rule goes away. And the description of that is, well, the rule's gone away. Your case is now moot, as it's not real anymore. It's just a theoretical question. And courts will generally not hear cases that are moot. However, they do have the discretion to do so. And they exercise that discretion in accordance with a test that's been developed in the case law. And so it's not an absolute thing, but they also don't want to waste their time hearing and deciding cases that don't matter anymore. And one of the examples of this was the challenge to the vaccine travel mandate of the federal government, which was dismissed for being moot once the rule was repealed. But what that leaves us with are these very big questions about the scope of the government's power to order us around and tell us what to do. We don't know if that was legal or not. And so the difficulty here is that if the court declines to exercise its discretion to hear these cases once the rule goes away, then it is possible that the government will think that it has the authority and to do it again the next time around. If you have this mootness rule, then here's what the government can do. They can put in place some kind of draconian rule, and somebody can challenge it in court, and courts are, you know, pretty slow sometimes. You can get things on an expedited basis occasionally, but sometimes it's slow. And the government can calculate that they're going to keep the rule in place until the moment before the case is heard by the court. And then once the case is taken up, we'll get rid of the rule, we'll cause the case to be moot, the court will dismiss it, and as soon as it's dismissed, we'll put the rule back on. And then the same thing again and again and again. Now, hopefully, eventually, the court would say, well, you know, they're playing cat and mouse here with us. We'll hear this case. But that's the potential for governments in this kind of COVID situation. The fact that they took all the rules down just in time to avoid the court looking at them means that there's no court judgment now saying that all these extreme things that they did didn't have lawful authority. We don't have that opportunity.
Could you apply what you're talking about when it refers to government, delegation, deference, and mootness, putting aside discretion at the moment, and apply it to what we've seen in individuals and how they've responded in the last few years to the actions of government? And I'm talking about we delegate our fact-finding and knowledge to organizations like the news media, journalists.
Yeah.
We defer to the experts, you know, right, when it comes to medical officers of health or colleges of physicians and surgeons who may be comprised of people who aren't even physicians and surgeons. And after all is said and done, we seem to forgive and forget, at least a lot of us do. This points to mootness. If I go to a person on the street now and we want to talk about what happened during these last dreadful 3 years, a lot of people would just go, it's over, move on. That's right to them.
Right. Interesting. Yes. Interesting parallel.
Yeah. So it holds, does it? The deference, delegation, and mootness seems to be a disease, not only of corporate Canada, the governance, but also of individuals.
It's an interesting way to put it. So the difference for me between the two situations is that bottom line is people can do what they want and it doesn't affect anybody else. If you want to delegate your thinking to the news media, if you want to, you know, defer your judgment to the public health officials, I mean, not what I would recommend, but you're allowed. Yes. Whereas it might have an overall effect. If lots and lots of people do the same thing, then you get a population just following directives from these institutions, which is not a good thing. But they're free people. And if they want to be sort of intellectually lazy like that, then they can be. It's unfortunate. And it's not the kind of thing that we need to happen in a society that purports to be free. On the other hand, it's a lot of work, right? I mean, to be a free citizen, here's one of the misnomers I think that we suffer from, a misconception. misconception that we are owed the truth from the news media, from the government, from whoever you can think of, that we are owed the truth. In a free country, that's probably not true. In fact, I think the premise in a free country should be the opposite, that whatever you hear from the news media, from government officials, or as the case may be, you should assume it's wrong. You know, you should hear it with skepticism and understand that your job as a free citizen is to think these things through for yourself. And if you don't take that on and you delegate and defer, well, then you sort of get what you deserve.
Yeah, I don't bring it up necessarily as an attack on a person's right to think for themselves or anything like that, or not in a legal sense, but in more in a psychological sense. I think
it's
an identification of human nature to be intellectually lazy.
I think that's fair. Sure.
Yeah.
When we think about government, and obviously it would certainly seem that the public confidence is under stress in Canada, and there have been just one scandal after another when it comes to government, politicians, and so forth. Yet we need to, I think, step back and look at it and say, okay, what is the role of our government? And in particular, what is a role of Parliament? Now, I know you've done a lot of study, a lot of work in researching the role of government through the years. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you have discovered in your own personal study.
Among the citizens, what you found was a common ground of belief that citizens mattered. And underpinning that was a very interesting notion, which is largely disappearing now in our society. And that was the notion that there was an omnipotent created God who created and loved us all. Now, whether this is a true story or a myth, it doesn't really matter. The fact is it took hold in society and it had profound consequences. And one of the consequences, one of the significant consequences, is that if God created and loved us all, then all of us matter. And we as individuals have no right to cause harm or abuse or exploit other citizens. That principle, you see it reflected, for example, very explicitly in Hammurabi's code, that the Hammurabi is there as the leader, but his job is not to impose his will. His job is to exercise the duties assigned to him by this omnipotent creating God. There are other articulations of this. Not everyone used the term God. You find in Aristotle and Plato the term right reason. They use the term natural law. And the natural law you find is the same sort of concept that all persons matter. They all have to be treated with respect. You cannot use them as a means to achieving your end. They are there as an end in themselves. And your job is to respect that and to live in harmony with everyone else. You see that being reflected in those old times. You see it in you see it in Cicero. You see it in the ancient Roman codes. In that the ancient Roman code.
Right.
You see it in Aristotle and Plato, too. They draw a distinction between what is a law and what is an administrative rule. And the laws tended to be beyond government. Governments are bound to live under the law. And, of course, they can develop administrative rules. They can say you can make a rule that you pay this much taxes. This is how taxes are collected. This is how they're distributed. But those administrative rules have to be subordinate to a set of principles which essentially say all persons matter and they have to be treated with respect. No one can abuse, no one can exploit. In Rome, they had a clear distinction on this, in that they had a distinction between leges and jus, J-U-S. And the jus were the, that is justice. Those are the laws that pre-exist government, that governments are bound by. And the leges are the legislation.
Right.
Which at the administrative type rules.
And so 1867 was the statute that was passed in Imperial Parliament. So here it is, you know, let me read the opening thing because this is very important. It says, the very opening sentence, it says, an act, that's a statute, an act for the Union of Canada, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick, and the government thereof, and for the purposes connected therewith. Whereas the provinces of Canada, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick have expressed the desire, that's the petition, have expressed the desire to be federally united into one dominion under the crown of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, with a constitution similar in principle to that of the United Kingdom. Okay, so if you parse these words, that means if you work on these words, what they mean, which is what the lawyers do, and especially constitutional lawyers, with the constitution, so the act in the opening of the sentence will become the constitution of this new confederation.
Right.
Okay, but it is a statute in its origin,
right,
being passed by the Imperial Parliament.
The BNA Act.
Yeah, and it will become a constitution which will be similar in principle. It doesn't say similar in constitution of Great Britain or United Kingdom. It says similar in principle. Why? Because Britain doesn't have a written constitution.
Right.
So what does Britain have under which the Parliament of Great Britain, the Imperial Parliament of Great Britain, gave to Canada the constitution that would be under the principle of the United Kingdom?
Right.
Fascinating, fascinating. And for 165 years, we are in 165 years, Mark, nobody, and I'm saying this emphatically, not in any sense of arrogance and hubris, historical fact. Nobody in these 165 years thought about what it is that Canada is built upon.
Right.
Because it is you and I, that is us people now, we are representing the people. We are pointing out that Canada's constitution, Act of 1867, and added to that the Constitution Act of 1982, is based upon English law, and the English law is based upon common law and statutes.
Right.
Britain doesn't have a written constitution like the United States have, and we now have, but our constitution is still tied up with the mother's womb. We have not cut the umbilical cord. So it is English law. And here is the important point. The heart of the matter, under the English law, unwritten and statutory, the supremacy, the sovereign, the supremacy of the Parliament is what matters. It is right. Parliament that is supreme, not the people, not exactly. The monarch.
Exactly.
That when you talk about the Charter of Rights and Freedom under the British law, there is no rights and freedom except the rights and freedom that is granted by the Parliament.
Right, exactly.
You're listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And the voice you just heard was, of course, our own Salim Mansour, but as he appeared with Mark Friesen on his show back on March 17th. And now, back to our discussion with Bruce Pardy.
The preamble to our Constitution says, whereas Canada is founded upon principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law, you have these rights, which we can take away. A good friend of both of ours,
yes,
Salim Mansour, has suggested in a Substack of his that we add these words, and in doing so, bring the Constitution back to the people rather than Parliament or the Crown. And that is, at the end of that statement, simply put in, derived from the will of the people. Because in constitutions like in the United States, or at least in the founding documents, they have we the people.
Mm-hmm.
in India. It says, we, the people of India, do proclaim these things, that we're a socialist state, which is true. But in Canada, nowhere in our founding documents or constitution does it say that the people are sovereign and that all of our rights come from us and are not to be imposed or given to us as liberties. They're inalienable to us, and we give Parliament power. That's not here. That's not this country. Can a comment on that?
The articulation of our form of government, I think, does tend to be more paternalistic than the examples that you cited in the US and India and so on. But I'm not sure that it has practical implications, because the US, for example, is in a lot of trouble in many of these same respects as well. So yes, I'm not against articulating that notion, but I'm not sure what difference it would make.
It's more psychological, I think. It gives the people an understanding that Parliament is a servant of the people. True, it is often ignored, much like most of our rights are ignored. But I would posit that to have something like that puts a notion in people's minds that is not there right now. In the United States, if you cross the border, they have an implicit understanding of the role of government and the people, more so than we do here, I think. And just having that kind of a statement in there, as you're correct, that it's probably not practical, but it is a psychological or philosophic.
That's fair. And I do think there is a very healthy American skepticism about the power of government that we lack in this country. So perhaps that would go some way to fixing that. We do have a different set of expectations in a culture that, after all, we are the place where the people who did not want to rebel against the king came to, so as, you know, not to ruffle those feathers, if I could put it that way. So it might be that we come to our cultural sensibilities honestly, even if they're not good ones, at least as seen by you and I and other people like us. I think that notion is a healthy one, that all government power derives from the people. But I think it can also be overdone, because people can think in practical terms that it means more than it really does. We still do have in this country, like in the US and other democracies, the idea of democracy, which, you know, it's not working very well, but nevertheless, there's at least elections. And if you didn't have that as the practical application of the idea that the power comes from the people, then what would you use? People think, here's another example. During COVID, one of the objections that I heard a lot from people who opposed all of these crazy policies was that the government hadn't shown us that what they were doing was correct. They hadn't shown us the evidence. They hadn't consulted with us. They hadn't passed it by us. They did it on their own accord. They did it on the basis of very poor science and so on. Where's the justification? And that reflects a misconception about what government is and what powers it has. Once you win an election, you are entitled to make laws and policies. And you don't have to justify them to anyone. That's the power of the legislature. If you have a body of elected MPs or MPPs, and they pass a statute, that statute can say anything, as long as it's not unconstitutional. If it's not unconstitutional, that statute can do things that are silly, that are obtuse, that are objectionable, that have no backing in scientific evidence. They can do anything they want, as long as it's not unconstitutional, and of course within their jurisdictional power to do. But there's no justification process required.
That brings up the question of accountability, I think, which you touched upon in your testimony. And that is, how do you hold accountable on both ends, the judiciary and the legislature? For the legislature's part, if they delegate their lawmaking to the executive branch, then how do you hold them accountable? And I'll give you an example. In the United States, the Obamacare Act, the Affordable Care Act, was 2,700 pages long.
Right.
Nobody read it.
Right.
Even the people who wrote it in sections, so they didn't even read it.
Right.
That's right. Because in the Constitution of the United States, Article 1 says that the legislative powers reside only within Congress. They don't reside with the executive. Right?
Well, right. But we have the same principle.
Oh, do we?
We do have the same principle. That's where we start. That's where the separation of powers begins. And courts have said this many times as a principle. The principle is that the executive branch of government, and a couple of exceptions, but let's not worry about the exceptions right now. As a general principle, the executive branch of government has no power to do anything except as is provided to them in a statute. And that's one reason, that's one rationale that our courts have given over time for allowing legislatures to delegate their lawmaking authority to the executive branch. They say, well, the executive branch has no power to do anything except those powers that are given to them in a statute. And these are powers given to them in a statute. The legislature has decided to delegate these powers to the executive branch. And we're not going to interfere with that because it's the legislature. It's elected. It's decided that's what it wants to do. So away you go.
Well, I understand the principle. Yep. Yeah, for sure. As a matter of fact, there are sound reasons sometimes for allowing that to happen, to give the minister and his minister, you know, bureaucracy leeway to set regulations, right, as they occur, rather than going back to the legislature every time to manage something that may have come up, you know.
Well, as a practical matter, that's true, but here's the problem. So the further down that road you go in accepting that proposition, the further down the road of the administrative state and its necessity we go. So here's a competing philosophy, if you like, and it's a very impractical one in present day, would appear to be that part of the rule of law, this is one thing that Friedrich Hayek said, one of the characteristics of a robust rule of law is rules that are fixed and announced beforehand. That is, if you're a citizen, you should be able to go and look up the rules in the book, understand what they are, and then govern your behavior accordingly. What we don't want is governments making up rules on the fly because nobody knows what they are. No one knows what they're going to be tomorrow. You can't plan your own affairs on the basis of that kind of rulemaking. Sometimes they're not published. We don't know what the rationale was. There's no debate in public. You can't have the minister with the powers to do too many things other than to carry out, to execute, that's where the word comes from, the executive branch of government, to execute the rules as provided for in the statute. So here's a good example of that model. In the criminal code, the rules are in the code. You know, if you're accused of murder, then, you know, all you have to do is look up the definition of murder in the code and you'll see what it says. And the requirements of the offense are in the definition. Now, not always certain. It's not that there's no gray, but that's the statement that the legislature has made about what's prohibited, as opposed to so many of the rules that apply to us today on a day-to-day basis that are in, I mean, regulations are one thing. Regulations are at least a little bit formalized. There's at least a formal process for making a regulation. There's also, you know, policies and guidelines and practices and ad hocery. So many times, In the here and now, we have officials of all different kinds making all different kinds of decisions about what's in the public interest without really going through any public process about what that result's going to be. And the more we accept the proposition that this is necessary to run a modern society, to manage a modern society, you're going to have things like COVID happen.
I guess it's the excesses that we're addressing here rather than the rule necessarily. It's the overreach.
I'm not sure that I agree. I think that if you accept the premise of the administrative state, and then you are going to get overreach, because the premise is essentially that it is the job of people in the government, you know, the experts and the bureaucrats, to manage society, to fix social problems. I disagree. I do not agree that it is the role of people inside the government to fix social problems. What I think the role of government is to tell us what the general rules are that define the relationship between each one of us to the other and between us and the state. If you have those general abstract rules that apply to everybody all the time, you know, rules of contract and rules of property and rules of process, then you really shouldn't need the kind of administrative state that we have now. I'm basically describing what is sometimes called a night watchman state, a state that is there to keep the peace and to establish the basic principles, and then otherwise leaves people alone to make their own way.
Sounds wonderful.
So what we've got here is this idea of the ruler is in a fiduciary relationship, a relationship of trust between the government and the individuals or the citizens. And even though we would have different understandings down through the years with respect to exactly what that relationship looks like, but in a basic sense, it's the idea that the ruler is there not for their own self-aggrandizement, but simply to ensure that individuals are retreating properly. And that's why, of course, we have the notion of citizenship. And the idea here as well of justice, or jus, as you point out, J-U-S, and legate, or L-E-G-E-S. And so we got this idea of the law being an understanding that there is something outside of the state itself. In other words, law pre-exists the state, and the idea of natural law, the idea of a supreme being or beings, the idea of gods, the idea that there are certain basic instinctual understandings of what it means to be a human and what the relationships are to be between humans, the idea of fairness, just play, justice, and truth, and so on. We see that. So we got this big picture now of the idea and the understanding with respect to the roles of government and the roles of the law. Okay, so I just wanted to reiterate that. And as you're saying now, in Rome.
So in Rome, they had this distinction very clearly between the leges and the jus, justice and legislation. When decisions were taken, when conflicts arose between individuals, what you found is, I'll move to some of the British courts now, laws were often not written. They were understood. And when one of the first articulations in the British system of government was at the time of Alfred the Great. And if you look at the laws that he wrote, they began with the Ten Commandments. So there's your reflection of this set of rules by the creator, fully accepted by society at the time, this omnipotent, beneficent creator. And so the law was set under the Ten Commandments. You will follow this. And the king's duty was to uphold that. So in the courts, in the British courts, the job of the courts, when you had a conflict, someone says, I think this is just, and someone else says, this is just based on this principle or this principle. The job of the courts was to assess this against those fundamental unwritten rules. They were to discover, in effect, what God would do in resolving this conflict between the rights of different individuals. But the job was to discover what the courts would do, what God would do. Can look at the articulations. There's several of them. There's a 13th century articulation of the law in Britain, a very detailed description of this. You find it in Germany in a document called the Sachsenspiegel. You find it in Britain in the 17th century in Blackstone. And you find, again, that these principles are articulated over and over again. The role of the courts in keeping a society civil and civilized is to discover what is the right thing to do. Very clearly in that articulation, the job of governments is the role of trustee, of protecting the rights of persons. Governments have immense power, of course, but the power can only legitimately be used to uphold those rights of each and every citizen. They cannot use the power to impose their own will and take away those God-given rights, those natural rights, those right reason kind of rights of individuals who are free and have a right to be free, do whatever they wish, as long as they do not impinge on or harm the rights of any other person.
Let's talk about the courts. The courts disappoint me when they defer. It seems to me that a judge today, in general, are saying that, yes, your rights were violated. However, it's justifiable under Section 1, you know, in free and democratic society. Remember, Brian Peckford stood on the steps, I think it was at the Supreme Court, during the Truckers' Freedom Convoy, saying, retrospectively, I might add, that Section 1, and he was there, was for war and insurrection and dangers to the existence of the states, existential threats to the well-being of the country as a nation. I never heard Mr. Peckford, and we owe a lot to Brian Peckford.
Yes.
We certainly do. But I never heard him come out and vehemently stand on the steps of a courthouse and say, this is not what we meant. Your thoughts?
The problem is that that's not what it says. If you actually looked at the text of Section 1, it does not say, you know, in extreme situations of war and insurrection, then maybe you can violate one of these charter rights. It doesn't say that.
True.
It's reasonable limits in a free and democratic society. This is often the case with the law. There are inherent ambiguities in language. Here's the bottom line. It is difficult to dictate outcomes that are in opposition to your culture. Law is a product of culture. And if you're expecting a document to hold back the culture, that's probably not going to happen. And so we don't want to paint this inaccurately, too. It is not the case that the courts have suddenly declined to enforce any charter rights. That is just not true. They enforce charter rights all the time. But if you look at the pattern over the long period, the pattern, I think, tends to be that they take an expansive interpretation of rights when the cause tends to be a progressive one.
I guess that comes back to the culture thing. And I'm glad you said that because, of course, in any society, if you read the constitution of communist China, there are rights listed,
yes,
enumerated
rights
in there.
Exactly.
Of course, they're violated every day because the person who owns the guns sets the rules and can enforce them the way, whatever the way they want. So would our Charter of Rights and Freedoms and our Constitution and this this whole 800 years of common law precedent, is it all a facade?
There is something to it in this sense. I mean, one of the ways to define law is to say that it is a political language that legitimizes political decisions. That's a sort of an anthropological explanation for it, that the substance of it is less in the substance and more in the ritual than anything else. It's a political language that legitimizes social outcomes.
Fascinating and profound. I'd like to ask your opinion on the difference between civil rights, charter rights, and inalienable rights.
Here's the problem when you use the word right. Right is a term of art in the law. It means a certain thing. There's a legal saying that goes, there's no right without a remedy. Meaning, if you actually have a right, a legal right, and it's been breached, well, then you can go to a court and get a remedy for it. But the opposite also applies. If you go to a court looking for a remedy for the breach of your right, and the court says, sorry, no remedy for that, that means that legally you had no right. The right that you claimed, sorry, doesn't exist. When we in the law speak of rights, we're speaking of actual concrete things that courts will act upon. And that's to contrast with what a lot of people talk about, you know, quite rightly, talking about their inalienable rights. Those are rights that they think they ought to have, or in a moral sense, do have. In a moral, philosophical sense, absolutely do have, but not necessarily legally. And one has to make the clear distinction and identify what you're talking about. Are you talking about a moral argument, or a historical argument, or a philosophical argument, or a legal argument?
I guess that the word inalienable is rather alien to a lot of Canadians. In the United States, they may have a little bit more of a gut reaction to it. But to me, it simply means it doesn't come from the other. In other words, my rights are not given to me. just because they're not enumerated in a constitution or by my government doesn't mean that I don't have them.
It doesn't mean you don't have them, again, in the moral, philosophical, God-given sense. I grant you that. But you're now speaking a different language than the law.
How would you like to see this road go down? Do you want to see a more, our documents and our legal system become more in line with what we as individuals think of as inalienable rights? Or do you see us going down a pattern of more of a Napoleonic code where this is written, this is the way it is, mm-hmm. you must obey, mm-hmm. and it's not going to get changed? What would you prefer?
I would love to see changes to our Constitution. I would love to see them go in the direction that you're describing, embracing the idea of individual rights and liberties. People have made the observation that the Charter is more akin to a continental code than it is like a common law set of propositions. But the problem practically is that if we were to find a way to open up the Constitution to revision with the objective of changing the Constitution in some very important ways, the danger is that if you open it up, because of the state of the culture right now and the state of the views of the establishment, of the prevailing order about what government is for and the triumph of the administrative state, the likelihood is that once you open it up, it's going to get worse, not better. It is a product of culture. And if your culture is in a bad state, you're not going to be able to amend it so as to push the culture back. The culture is going to embrace it and make it reflect what the flavor of the day is. And the flavor of the day is that experts and officials have the authority and expertise to manage society and tell us what to do. That's where we're at. That's the problem with the administrative state. And you could make it worse. You can open up the document and incorporate that proposition into an even worse kind of Section 1. And you'd be left in a worse situation than you are now.
So our task is daunting, isn't it? We have to change culture to change law.
Yeah.
Yeah, easily done. Sure. Always a pleasure, Bruce. Thank you very much. I love your insight. And people should go to your website, rightsprobe.org. to find out more about Bruce Pardee and the work he's been doing. A lot of videos there, a lot of food for thought. Thank you once again, Bruce.
Thank you, Robert. Appreciate it.
So, change the culture. Well, at least it's a simple fix. It's just not easy. Nothing affects a culture more than speaking out, especially at a time when moving in the right direction means swimming upstream against a culture bent on self-destruction and nihilism. But do so we must, for otherwise our freedoms themselves may become moot, as will be the meaning and significance of each individual's life on earth. And speaking out, we shall continue to do. And maybe that's the most important reason for you to join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
When a guy breaks up with his girlfriend, what is an appropriate amount of time to wait before you make a move?
Oh, I'd say about a month.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I'd say 3 to 4.
Half hour.
Interesting. When it's your assistant, I would say never.
All right, Rach, the big question is, does he like you? Right? Because if he doesn't like you, this is all a moo point.
Huh. A moo point?
Yeah. It's like a cow's opinion. You know? It just doesn't matter. It's moo.